not going to speak about specific minerals. I got a little nervous watching everybody else doing this, and I thought, oh my goodness, they've got minerals here on this landscape, minerals here on that landscape. I'm going to preface this discussion in the fact that I deal with a lot of geologists, and I have a PhD in geology, and I have, as of late, developed somewhat of a following as a paleosol expert. And so I'm constantly looking for how processes in modern soils can be evaluated and translated into paleosol records. And so one of the lucky things that happened to me was to be able to move to Wisconsin and get a chance to work in the Driftless area, which actually has a fairly ancient landscape to it, but that has been affected by modern inputs, or at least quaternary inputs. I'd like to thank also Krista, my tireless colleague, who puts in a lot of commentary on this, and a lot of data has gone in that's come from her work. My structure of my talk will basically be to give you an introduction and tell you some of the objectives and hypotheses, give you a description of the southern Driftless area soilscape and some of the mineralogy. I see that typo did not get out of there. Evidence of two parent material contributions to a present-day solar on the soilscape in the Driftless area, and some interpretations, which is what geologists are really good at doing, of the long-term soil evolution of the southern Driftless area. Well, I was kind of got interested in this thinking about, or at least examining, the red clay soils that form over the dolomite in the Driftless area, and thinking about Terra Rosa formation and Terra Rosa soils. And then converging on that was also an interest in dust and how dust affects landscapes and soilscapes overall, and how soils are not simply formed from single parent materials, as many of my geological colleagues tend to think, that soils are formed from simply a simple parent material, and the weathering index can be easily measured. But there's frequently a complex of parent materials. And how can we evaluate pedogenesis in complexes if we don't know what our original chemistry is from our mineralogy is of our parent materials? So I thought, well, maybe I need to start with a relatively simple system. And as I always like to do, I like to use resistant phases, things like zircons, which at the University of Wisconsin, we've dated the oldest zircon in the world. And the phrase going around the University of Wisconsin is that zircons are forever. And also things like titanite and sphene and rutile. We have a lot of rutilated quartz in this lust material that I'm going to be looking at. And seeing those variations that we see, that we find, and using what I've done is recalculate some indices based on the geochemical strain that has been commonly used in mass balance equations. So my relatively simple mineralogic system is lust over dolostone in the southern Driftless area. And as always, I like to use titanium and zirconium compositions, which are strongly contrasting in these two parent materials. It's essentially very high for lust and low for the dolostone. We also have to keep in mind that in this part of the world, the lust cover is not very deep. It's not like Iowa, Nebraska, some of those places that have tens of meters of lust cover. This is actually no thicker than 2 meters and actually thins out quite rapidly as you move away from the Mississippi River. And one of the things that I'm very interested in looking at is the Roundtree Formation, which is a formal stratigraphic unit that is time transgressive, that is comprised of red clay, or red to chocolate red clays. And then I'm going to try to think about what kind of a long-term pedogenic progression happened here that involved episodes of lust depositions. Again, they're not very thick, and the lust tends to be very acidic lust. And there's also been landscape rearrangement through erosion, and then dolostone dissolution. So my objectives here were to look at the contrasting properties of the lust-derived materials, the carbonatic bedrock, which is primarily dolostone here, and the clay-rich subsoil. Then suggest these pedogenic relationships through a whole rock geochemistry, which is how I can translate this modern analog into ancient paleosols, focusing on the titanium and zirconium containing phases, and develop what I call a contribution index, or you may want to call it a similarity index, that shows the role of loss in the formation and the sustained development of these red clays in the Roundtree Formation. Our geographic setting here, the driftless area, is shown over there with the dark line. There's some areas that have had earlier glaciations up there in the northwest corner and also over on the eastern edge. This driftless area is actually the boundary for MLRA 105 in Wisconsin. And you can see that there are some areas in here. This portion right in here is Cambrian age dolomite and shales. And then when we're down up here, we actually have the St. Peter Formation, which is famous for its beautiful clean sand. And then when we get farther south, we're actually moving up into the Ordovician with the Sinope group with dolomite and some limestone and shale in it. These landscapes are highly dissected, as you see the downcutting that's in these river valleys. And it also has very broad peneplains in here that have formed the rich farming soils of this region. And one thing we have to keep in mind is that this is the old cratonic edge farther up to the north here. And as you move away, you're into the volcanic province here that is actually prior to this deposit of lime dolostones here in the Cambrian. So the bedrock geology here, we're talking about something that's up to 400 million years old and has been weathering through karst processes and being eroded and destroyed and accumulating over many, many, many millennia and many ages in geology. When we look at the landscape, we see these nice long slopes. This is my study area right in here that I showed on the previous map. This is just showing a shaded relief that shows this slope right here on this slide. And you see there are long convex slopes in here. And here's looking back up at this slope here where some of our pits were. This long convexity is caused by not simply by loess erosion but or loess deposition, but also by the movement of deposits downslope in a solifluction mode when the glaciers were all around the driftless area. And so we have these long slopes that take a long time to walk up. You keep walking uphill and you think you're getting to the top and you just keep going on. But this kind of dictates how our soils will look as well, because you can see here, and this is, we actually did a study to kind of look at the contrast between warm and cool slope aspects in terms of petogenesis. Turned out it didn't really make a lot of difference, but except in the depth of the profiles. But what we see here are some stone lines and previous eroded materials and pedisediments that have come down. But notice how red this is compared to the dark topsoil over the top, over the in the epipedon of this soil. In the cool slope aspects, the profiles are shallower. You're actually getting down into the dolostone right here. And right in here, you can actually see some of the Roundtree Formation in there. But over here, it's kind of nondescript. You still see some of the dolostone down here and some of the red clay on top. Some of the most outstanding features that we see are actually on the interfluves, where there are, again, there's patterned ground that's been documented from aerial photography. We go in and look at these. And what these actually are what I call funnel dolines, and this comes from working in the karst regions of East Tennessee. I've seen these things, and they're filled with this red clay, and we used to call this a cave clay. And actually what we believe happens with these mechanisms, these dolines, is that once water gets down into them, and during the periglacial times especially, the freezing and thawing would actually expand these out, and so that we kind of tend to call them dolines ice wedge casts as well. And they're found in most of the interfluve positions in these areas. When you look at through the microscope at the mineralogy, that the mineral composition, or at least the fabric of this upper portion of the soil, you see that we have a lot of silt-sized grains in here. We have a lot of quartz, feldspars, mostly plagioclase, and micas. We have a soil fabric that is somewhat zoned, and a lot of sub-rounded grains, although there are a few nice edgy ones in there as well. And the textures in these surface soils are silt loams to silts. When we look at the clay mineralogy of these AP horizons, we don't see anything real definite other than we know we have mica in here, and this is the clay size fraction, and kaolinite. Keep in mind that this is coming off of the red acid tills from the superior lobe that tend to have a lot of oxides and also carry kaolinite with them. And of course a lot of quartz. And in the coarser fractions, we did actually see the feldspar a lot better. But you don't see a lot of smectite building up in there. When we look at the dolestone fabric, see a beautiful carbonate fabric, and we also can disaggregate this in some cases in the very fine sands, or fine sands, where we have a nice baroque to saddle dolomite grains that have been loosely cemented with iron. And so this is what we see down in here. And here again, you can see this red clay in here. This happens to be an injection feature where red clay was getting into the beds of the dolostone and was an irregular large cavity that was filled in with clay there. When you get into the Round Tree Formation itself, what you see is a very complex fabric with zone striations, speckled B fabric. Some cases earthworms have worked their way down there, and there's fecal pellets and there's irregular bugs in here. The textures here, we have up to 85% clay in these. And it's mostly fine to very fine clay, so we know that this is formed by secondary precipitation. When we look at the clay mineralogy of this, we do see a nice broad smectite peak. We see very little kaolinite at all. And the clay does not completely expand out, so we suspect that we have some cementation in the inner layer. These are true montmorillonites because we did do a test to see what smectite we had in here. Well, one of the things I like to do is I respect my elders, and I think that they've done a lot of good work at trying to differentiate where parent material shifts might occur. And so I went back to an old friend of mine, which was the titanium to zirconium ratio. And what you're seeing in this graph on the x-axis is the titanium-zirconium ratio, but on the y-axis is simply a canonical division of and grouping of the soil horizons that I ran into in these locations. So what we see here is a pretty tight grouping in the AP and also in the BT1s. As we get into the 2BT, which is a second lithological unit that we have and may represent an older lust deposit in here, we see that our spread starts to move out. And the reason that this spread moves out, you see how it's really getting broad down here in the lower 3BT horizons, these are the third lithologic unit we have there, is because titanium is increasing. Zirconium is decreasing systematically, titanium is increasing systematically, and it is directly tied to the amount of iron that is in those soils. Then when we get down to the parent material itself, we have a widespread, and this is in the 3BC and 3C material, but the actual parent material, and I did measure the contents of two examples that I had, it actually shows that the lust unit, I took two or three measurements from this, falls right in here, and the galena dolomite falls right along in here. Now, this is shows that it's not very much different from what you're finding here, but they're awful close together, so they're not very good to use as an index because they're simply too close together, the parent materials. So I came up with a contribution index. And what I did with this was that I looked at the volumetric molar contents of the titanium and zirconium of the two components. In my lust parent material, the titanium amount, and this is the standard deviation, is fairly high, and the zirconium as well, and this is in millimoles per cubic centimeter. When I got down to the dolostone, and I could only show one sample here because it took me a lot of Dolostone to get enough solid material to process and run on the XRF, is that my Dolostone parent material is about 1/60th of titanium content, and obviously it's 70 times more zirconium in the loss. And so I developed these two equations based on my two parent material compositions. I have a contribution index for titanium basis and contribution index for the loss based on zirconium. And I'm just going to show you some graphs of how that contribution index works. Again, on this I have depth on the y-axis, and what I'm showing here are the contribution index values. Keep in mind that if you have a value of 1, that means that you are at the loss level, and if you are at a value of 0, you are at the Dolostone level. And the bars that you see here indicate the ranges I had in depths along here and the ranges of contribution indices I had in this. Now this is the upper solum, and this is on a titanium basis. This is the second lithologic unit in here, and you see a wide range of depths, but you don't see a wide variation in the contribution index. So these all pretty much lay on the same line, which indicates that there is probably the same degree of weathering that's gone on in the second lithologic unit. When we get down to the third lithologic unit, we have, of course, some of these are getting closer in terms of depth to what we had in these second lithologic units. So the values are very similar in the contribution index and have some overlap. But as it gets deeper into the profile, we actually see that these contribution indices start to approach 0. And this is backed up, some of this information is actually backed up by the presence of ferrotitanite that I was able to locate using an EDX, looking at some specific occurrences in soil horizons. Now we're going to look at this as a zirconium basis, and I think this actually works pretty well here. It differentiates out pretty nicely. In the upper solum, we see again kind of a pattern like this, and I attribute this increase right in here and this decrease there to the fact that we simply have more organic matter working into the upper AP, and this causes somewhat of a dilution of the zirconium and the titanium in both cases. When we look at the second lithologic unit, we see that our zirconium contribution index moves downhill as we get deeper, which is what we expect it to do. And when we finally get down into this third lithologic unit, we see this overlap a little bit here in this 3BT3 group, but we see that this drops to 0, which is what we expect because it is very, very close to the Dolostone parent material. And actually, I looked at the regression of the second lithologic unit, and I see that I've got a pretty strong relationship there. The difference between these contribution indices, what does that mean? Up here you see that the mean titanium basis was always lower than that of the zirconium basis. I think that that has to do with simply the fact that the dust affects the surface directly in a more dynamic fashion. When you get deeper into the profile, you see that the titanium basis contribution index does not, it is higher than the zirconium basis. And that is, again, because titanium is reserved or preserved in the iron oxides that are associated with the clays. And finally, when we get down here, we just have a pretty close association into the C material. So in concluding, I'd like to say about my pedogenic model that in this setting, soil formation is dominated by the lust mineral transformations. It makes the clay that's coming in there. There has to be a freshening of this parent material every once in a while because it does deplete over time, and you do not have the material to translocate down into the soil profile. The carbonate bedrock stabilizes these clays. The pH and the chemistry keeps the aggregation of these clays very strong, and so they stick around for a long time. And another thing I noticed, I didn't show very much of this data, but what seems to be a small contribution of elements bicarbonates are cumulative through time, especially if you're talking about millions of years of weathering. So I believe that some of the iron that is coming out, certainly certainly some of the titanium that's coming out actually came from the carbonate and made a play and made a component of that material down in the deeper horizons. The Lust contribution indices, they actually show the allogenic, that dust base process that's going on in the these soils, and also orthogenic, which are the titanium-based processes. If you look at the difference between those contribution indices and see where one is greater than the other. And I can entertain some questions. And thank you very much for your attention.
I assume the basis for determining this concentrations of titanium and zirconium was on a soil-based, total soil basis?
Yes, it was.
And when you did the volumetric expressions, what was the basis?
I simply used our bulk density values, our dry bulk density values that we got from the soil, and then...
When you did the titanium, titanium, zirconium concentration on your gallstone, did you dissolve the carbonate first?
Yes, I did. It took a long time and a lot of material because it was 98% pure carbonate, so it took a lot of material, and I ground it down and added acid to it for a couple of weeks. And that's
well, the basis for that then was just the residue.
That's the residue, yes. Mm-hmm. Good question. Thank you, Tassos.
Any other questions?
Oh, thank you.